Thank you very much. The first thing I want to say is to extend our thanks today, actually, to the Friends Meeting House and its organisers, for two reasons. They're due thanks from the Stop the War Coalition, because they've been virtually our home since the very beginning. But they're due a special thanks today because they've been under considerable pressure all day to cancel this meeting. The neoconservatives grouped around the website Harry's Place have been organising today and have been getting people to email and call the Quakers who run the Friends Meeting House and trying to pressurise them into abandoning this meeting. I'm very glad to say that the friendship between the Stop the War Coalition and the people in the Friends Meeting House has prevented that from happening, and we wish to extend our thanks to the Friends Meeting House for allowing the meeting to go ahead. And I want to deal now with some of the arguments which are used by the neocons like Harry's Place and others sometimes about this kind of issue. And the first is about the stance that the Stop the War Coalition takes, and the Chair has been kind enough to refer to it. We have a very, very simple approach here. We do not require that people who join our demonstrations or are supporters of the Stop the War Coalition are supporters of the resistance in the Middle East. And nobody I've ever talked to in the Middle East, in the resistance, has ever thought that this was a good idea. For the very simple reason is that if you want 100,000 or 150,000 people on the streets of Britain, what you want is everybody who, for whatever reason, is opposed to the war. If they are Quakers and pacifists, like the people who run this hall, you want them on that demonstration. If they are people who have very severe criticisms and would not support the resistance, you want them on that demonstration. And that has been our policy from the beginning. But it has also been our policy that the resistance is a legitimate part of the movement. They are part of the movement in the Middle East. They are the central part of the movement in the Middle East. And it's not surprising, really, that if you're under military occupation, that one of the forms of resistance is a military resistance. That's what happens. It's what happened in France. It's what happened in Italy during the Second World War. It would have happened in this country had it been invaded in the Second World War. And you don't have to agree with that point of view, but you do have to recognise that if it happened to us, many, many people in this country would take a similar stance, and it would be an elementary democratic right, even if you did not agree with their choice, to listen to their argument and to hear what they have to say. And that is our position. I personally am a supporter of the resistance, but I think that even if I weren't, I would hope that I would be open-minded enough to listen to what they have to say, especially if I came from a country where the government and the media are working 24/7 to dissuade you from even listening to what people from the resistance have to say. Not just to dissuade you, by the way. My colleague Ibrahim Moussaoui, who has toured this country on the platforms of the Stop the War Coalition, who was due a couple of weeks ago to speak at SOAS at an academic conference, was prevented by the government from attending that conference. Now, I believe that you cannot have a government which preaches that it's going to fight to implement democratic rights throughout the Middle East that won't even listen to a representative of a democratically elected part of the government in the Middle East when they want to come and talk to an audience in this country. That is rank hypocrisy, and we won't have it in this movement. Now, there is another argument which says that virtually anybody who supports the resistance must, and who therefore is a critic, an opponent of the State of Israel, must therefore be an anti-Semite. That's an argument which has raged throughout the movement. It is still an accusation made today. Now, let me be absolutely clear. For us and for everybody in the resistance that I have met, either from Palestine or from Lebanon or in Egypt, they understand that Zionism is a political project to which we are opposed, and the Jewish people are something entirely different to that. They understand that not least because some of the strongest voices who are critical of the State of Israel are themselves Jews. If you listened to the voices speaking out over the last few weeks, especially during the attack on Gaza, one of the most striking things about them were the number of Jews who spoke out. Now, I've had very little cause in a long political career to praise Gerald Kaufman. But I'm going to now, because he made one of the most brilliant speeches in the House of Commons that I've heard for a very long time on precisely this issue. Now, if Gerald Kaufman, who has been a long-time friend of Israel, actually, can see now that there is something fundamentally wrong with what is happening, can say that his family's experience in the Holocaust should not be used to justify the current operations of the state of Israel, if he can see it, I do not see why anybody else in this country cannot see it either. And when you stand back for a moment and examine what is happening with Israel in the Middle East, it seems to me that you cannot help but arrive at a conclusion that gives you sympathy with the resistance. Because it is not simply that this tiny country in the Middle East is holding down the policy. To be honest, Israel has a population which is smaller than the population of London. There are more Jews living in New York State than there are in the state of Israel. They could not for a week or a month hold down the Palestinians on their own. They hold them down because they have the support of the most powerful military machine in the world and the biggest economy in the world, the United States of America. Consider this. Israel is the biggest recipient of US military aid in the world. It has over half of US military aid, more aid than the entire continent of Africa, more aid than the entire continent of Latin America. It has the biggest amount of US civilian aid in the world. It is the only country in the world that can purchase US arms directly from US arms manufacturers without having to go through the Department of Defense. It is the only country in the world that can use US military aid to purchase arms from other manufacturers outside the US. It is the only country in the world that can use US civilian aid for the purchase of military weapons. It is the only country in the Middle East, not Iran. Israel is the only country in the Middle East which is a nuclear power. It is the only country in the Middle East which has invaded every single country with which it borders. Now, Gordon Brown thinks he's got a special relationship with the United States, but actually Israel has got a really special relationship with the United States. That's the kind of relationship that's necessary for the United States, not because it simply wants to help the Israelis hold the Palestinians down. It wants to help Israel hold down every Arab in the region. That's why they pour that amount of money into the state of Israel. And therefore, those people, and they're not all, and by the way, the imperial architecture of the Middle East works in a funny way. The biggest amount of military aid goes to Israel, but the second amount of military aid goes to Hosni Mubarak's Egyptian state, and then the third amount goes to the Jordanian state. Why? Because Israel is paid to hold the Arabs down, and the Egyptian and Jordanian governments are paid not to attack Israel. That's America's architecture for the dominance of the Middle East. And when you know this, when you see this, how can you not say that people have a right to defend themselves? Have a right to say that this influence in our country would not be tolerated for a second by any state in the West. No state in the West would tolerate this. No state in the West would tolerate a neighbour, armed to the teeth, supplied, sustained, decade after decade, year after year, month after month, day after day, to impose the will of the most powerful state in the world on their region. We would not accept it. Why should we imagine that anybody in the Middle East should accept it for a single second? And it seems to me, therefore, that we have a responsibility. Our responsibility is to deal as best we can with our government. With our government that sends people, predominantly from working class communities, poor working class people, to travel thousands of miles away and kill other poor working class people who have nothing to drive them to fight each other, accept the desires of the rich and the powerful in their own countries. That's the first reason. The second reason is because everybody's life in this country is blighted by this. It is blighted economically. If we were to stop paying $3.5 billion a year for the occupation of Iraq, perhaps there'd be a few more people in jobs in this country in the recession. And here, it seems to me that we can only hope to win if something happens now, which happened the last time that American imperialism and its allies suffered a defeat in the Vietnam War. That we must rely on the resistance of people who are at the sharp end of imperialism. And we must try to bring such pressure here that they are caught between a rock and a hard place. That they are caught between people who will not give in to the imperial presence in their own societies and people here who will not give in when they see that kind of injustice visited on other people because they know that their loss is our loss as well. That's why we've tried to sustain the international anti-war movement and the anti-war movement in this country, not simply through the invasions and occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq, but through the movements against the war and invasion of Lebanon in 2006 and in solidarity with the people of Gaza in recent months. It is for them one single conflict. Central Command, CENTCOM, as the Americans call it, have two screens at their headquarters. One shows the Middle East, the other shows the theatre of operations around Afghanistan. They coordinate the armed responses in these two areas. They coordinate and calibrate the response in the Middle East with the response in what they now call AFPAC, Afghanistan and Pakistan. CENTCOM, AFPAC. The American military obviously has a problem with whole words. But nevertheless, if they coordinate it, then we must coordinate our response. They are after a global domination which suppresses ordinary people here and the ordinary people of the Middle East. And I think that it is in understanding that common struggle that we can all hope to rid ourselves of this massive injustice and this massive oppression inflicted not only on those people there, but on our people here.